This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we get a report from London on the continuing U.S. prosecution of the journalist Julian Assange.
Our guest, Chris Hedges, goes into detail about what might happen to Assange and the broader impact to free press worldwide.
We'll also talk about the investigation of the assassination of Malcolm X case.
Our guest will be attorney Flint Taylor, who will explain the role in the assassination of Malcolm played by the New York Police Department, the FBI, and the CIA.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Maria Hall, Los Angeles civil rights lawyer.
In the last few days, the case of imprisoned journalist Julian Assange, the co-founder of WikiLeaks, who published the truth about the multitude of war crimes committed by the United States and its allies in the course of their wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, was back in court in London, where Assange is fighting extradition back to the United States. He is charged in the U.S. under an obscure section of the 1917 U.S. Espionage Act. As Meek and Specia, writing yesterday in the New York Times, put it, the two-day hearing, and I quote, will determine whether he has exhausted his right to appeal within the U.K. and whether he could be one step closer to being back to the United States, close quote. And then she added, quote, and whether or not the people of the United States are one step closer to losing what is left of a free press in America and with it what is left of our democracy, close quote. Assange has been effectively incarcerated for years now, the last five of which in solitary confinement in a notoriously horrid British prison in London, where both his physical and mental health have been steadily deteriorating. Indeed, a lower court judge in his extradition case had ruled against extraditing him because of the strong likelihood he would die in an equally horrid U.S. prison. A nationwide and worldwide movement to free Julian Assange has been fighting for Assange's freedom for years now. Virtually all of the world's leading associations of journalists and human rights organizations have called for an end to the U.S. government's prosecution and persecution of Assange, as have major U.S. and foreign newspapers. Assange is an Australian citizen, and the Australian government has called for his release. Indeed, Australian Prime Minister Albanese says he did so when he recently met with President Biden. Well, why did the Trump administration decide to prosecute Assange in the first place? And as we now know, at one point plot to murder him. Why did the Obama administration decide not to continue with that prosecution? And why has the Biden administration nevertheless continued to do so? And if Julian Assange does lose his last appeal within the British courts, does he have any remaining legal remedies? To help us answer these and other questions concerning this grave challenge to freedom of the press and democracy in America, our guest today is the award-winning journalist and political writer, Chris Hedges. Chris Hedges reported for the New York Times from 1990 to 2005 and served as the Times' Middle East bureau chief and Balkan chief during the wars in the former Yugoslavia. In 2001, Hedges was one of the Times reporters on an entree that received the 2002 Pulitzer Prize for explanatory reporting. And prior to his work for the Times, he worked as a freelance war correspondent in Central America for the Christian Science Monitor, NPR, and the Dallas Morning News. His books include War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, which was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award for Nonfiction. Well, Chris Hedges, a very warm welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Thank you. Chris, you're now in London covering what may well be Julian Assange's last hope of getting the British courts to deny the U.S. request that he be sent back, extradited to the United States, stand trial, where if convicted, well, he faces up to 175 years in prison. So what can you tell us about these proceedings? What are the main arguments Assange's lawyers have been making, and how is the U.S. government responding?
I didn't think that it was a two-day hearing, and you're right, this is the final appeal. He had been ordered, the extradition had been green-lighted, and this was the two-judge panel in the high court. I don't think that the 2 days went well for the U.S. prosecution. I was a little surprised at how weak they were. The first day was the defense, they think they did a pretty good job. They hammered home the fact that I thought it was a very good legal argument that espionage legally is defined as a political offense, and that under the extradition treaty, people cannot be extradited in the Anglo-American extradition treaty for political offenses. But I was particularly surprised the second day, yesterday, when I listened to the prosecution and they were drawing all of their arguments, sometimes reading verbatim, from this very dubious U.S. federal prosecutor in the Eastern District of Virginia, Gordon Kromberg. And I had dealt with Kromberg years earlier. I'm a friend of Dr. Sami Alarian, the Palestinian activist, and right after 9/11, we saw a big push by the U.S. government under the Bush administration against Palestinian activists, trying to label them as terrorists, and against Palestinian charities such as the Holy Land Foundation. So Kromberg was at the forefront of these witch hunts. He also is very close to the far-right settler movement in Israel, calls the West Bank Judea Samaria, this kind of stuff. And these were trials where, you know, people had not really committed any crimes. They were being persecuted for their opinions. It was a kind of six-month show trial in Florida for Sammy, which, you know, replicated Julian's. And so they were pulling from his affidavit, which just was often completely false. For instance, the attorneys argued that the classified documents that Julian released in 2010, these are the Iraq and Afghan war logs, had never been redacted, and that because of that had jeopardized the lives of those who'd been named in the documents, and in the words of the prosecutors, caused some of them to quote-unquote disappear. Now, that's just not true. The documents which were released in partnership with The Guardian, The New York Times, and other major papers, Der Spiegel, were heavily redacted. That took weeks and weeks of work. And then the unredacted versions were published on a website called Cryptome. But that was only after two reporters from The Guardian published a book, and they put the passcode to the documents in the book. In fact, they used it to headline one of their chapters. So none of that had anything to do with Julian. And then the other point that they also were, and again were lifting from Kromberg, that has just been disproven, is this idea that Julian assisted Chelsea Manning in hacking the documents themselves. And that is just patently untrue, and it has been proven untrue. So, and it was interesting that the judges were very skeptical about this. And so my reading, walking away from it, is that they probably will grant, at least on some of the counts, an appeal. That won't happen for a while because both the defense team and the prosecution are, well, at least I know the defense, have to submit briefs by March 4th, so my guess is sometime in the spring they will issue a ruling. From the skepticism of the judges, who, especially on the redaction issue, I must have raised that about six different times. It certainly appeared that they were very skeptical as to that point. Now, if they do not grant the appeal, this is Julian's last chance. At that point, his only hope would be that he could request the European Court of Human Rights for a stay of execution under Rule 39, and that is given in, quote, exceptional circumstances, or, quote, only where there is imminent risk of irreparable harm. From the noises of the British government, they have cast doubt on whether they would honor an appeal to the European Court of Rights. And then, of course, what they could do is order Julian's immediate extradition prior to a Rule 39 instruction, or they could just ignore it altogether. So that's where we are. That was my read. I've covered this from the beginning. You know, one of the things, if there's a pattern, it's that there are just constant legal anomalies that are part of this case. I mean, for instance, we know because of leaks in Spain that the Spanish security firm UC Global, which did the security at the embassy, the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where Julian was given political asylum for 7 years, the only reason he couldn't leave is because the British government would not grant him safe passage from the embassy in London to Heathrow Airport. They recorded all of Julian's meetings with his attorneys and turned it over to the CIA, which, of course, eviscerates attorney-client privilege, and that alone should have invalidated the process. I mean, and there are a series of other issues. So if there is a pattern, it is that in this case, they just utterly ignore, you know, their own legal norms and to railroad Julian, who has not committed a crime. We should be very clear of that. There's a huge effort, of course, and that was part of it, which is not, has not, there's no, been no evidence that, indicates that he in any way was involved. I mean, first of all, Chelsea Manning didn't really need to hack into the computer. She had security clearance. So it's just not, they're desperately, the push on that is to try and tie him to a crime, but they've not been able to do that. So that's where we are.
Well, Chris Hedges, there seems to be no doubt that Julian Assange is a political prisoner. The Obama administration chose not to pursue extradition and prosecution because of what it called the quote-unquote New York Times problem. In other words, if they prosecute Assange for what he published, they might also have to prosecute the New York Times and other newspapers that published portions of those same documents. Talk to us about this. Why do you believe the Biden administration is ignoring this New York Times problem?
Because of Vault 7. So Vault 7, this was the leak that came out 6 years after, about 6 years, I think, after the extradition or after the release of the Iraqi war logs and diplomatic cables. And Vault 7 exposed, and we just saw the former CIA employee who leaked Vault 7 to WikiLeaks just got a 40-year sentence. But Vault 7 exposed the CIA's cyber warfare programs, the ability of them to take control of cars, smart TVs, web browsers, our phones, and the operating systems within these devices, and even if they're off, use them to record and surveil. And the CIA was apoplectic about that. And we heard these blood-curdling calls or attacks on Julian. Mike Pompeo was talking about, he was called WikiLeaks a hostile non-state intelligence service, and Trump even called for Julian's execution. And then we had that report in Politico about how there were discussions about assassinating or kidnapping Julian. So the Vault 7 information is not, the release of that information is not included in the extradition request, but I think it's widely believed that it was that release that drove, because the extradition request did not come until after Vault 7, and because of the reaction. Mike Pompeo was the head of the CIA. He's had a Senate resolution that attacked WikiLeaks, and that's when I think that's the engine behind it. So, and the defense brought that up. So, I mean, actually would, no doubt, if he was extradited, face charges for the release of Vault 7, which would exacerbate, and the defense even raised the possibility of capital punishment, but would exacerbate the 175 years he already faces under all of the accounts of the Espionage Act.
Yes, Chris, let's talk for a second about the seriousness and why this is so damned important. The seriousness of this prosecution and the opposition to it is evidenced, is it not, by the fact that, well, literally hundreds of thousands of parliamentarians, human rights groups, artists, journalists, medical authorities, teachers, trade unionists, you name it, are opposed and have demanded Assange's release. Daniel Ellsberg, while he was alive, was one of the co-chairs of the National Defense Committee for Julian Assange, offered to stand in his shoes and do the same thing, that sort of thing. The seriousness of it was clear. All of these together, calling for his release solely because they understand what? That if he's not freed, if he ends up imprisoned or dead because of what the U.S. is doing, it would be very rare for any journalist or publisher to dare to do what he did. And we would never have that kind of information about what our government is doing, right?
Yeah. So, yes, the New York Times and the Guardian and Der Spiegel and kind of belatedly, I think largely because of their lawyers, issued, in fact, what is a very good, in November of 22, an open letter titled Publishing is Not a Crime, because if Julian is found guilty for doing what journalists do, he did not like Ellsberg. Ellsberg actually took the documents. Ellsberg had signed non-disclosure agreements. You know, he wasn't Julian did not. Julian really functioned as a traditional publisher in that he was given or leaked the documents and then ran them. Now, I worked for the New York Times for 15 years. I periodically obtained classified documents and published them. But if Julian is found guilty, then just to possess those documents will be criminalized, much less to publish them. So that is the lifeblood of investigative journalism. We depend on sources, people within institutions that see malfeasance, that see wrongdoing, that are upset by lies, who are willing to speak to the press, and the press shines a light on that to hold power accountable. That is the traditional role of the press. That is precisely what Julian did. Now, remember, Obama used the Espionage Act, which, you know, is the equivalent of the British Foreign Secrets Act. It's not supposed to be used against journalists, to go after whistleblowers who provided information to the press, John Kiriakou, Sterling, and a bunch of other people. But Trump took that after the Vault 7 a step further by using the Espionage Act to go after a journalist, go after a publisher. I mean, we can just also, as an aside, note that Julian is not a U.S. citizen. WikiLeaks is not a U.S.-based publication. He was not in the U.S. when he was provided with those documents. I mean, there's all that issue as well. But yeah, it is, the wholesale surveillance has already had a very severe chilling effect on investigative journalism, because people who would reach out to journalists are now easily identified. That's why Snowden left the country. And this would essentially snuff it out. And anytime you allow powerful entities, institutions, government agencies to operate in secret, I mean, history has just shown this repeatedly, you get in terrible, terrible trouble. So yes, it has very severe consequences for journalism, but it also has very severe consequences for what is left of our rather anemic open society.
Chris Hedges, you mentioned earlier that if Assange loses this last appeal in the British courts against his extradition to the U.S., his last hope would be to challenge the legality of the U.S. extradition request in the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg, France. His attorneys have vowed to try and do that, but there's a fear that if he loses his appeal under British law, he'd be immediately swept up from his jail cell in London and thrown on a plane to the U.S. Is that a realistic fear?
Yes. And of course, once he's in the U.S., the European Court of Human Rights has no jurisdiction. And that has been a deep fear that and I should say, you know, having covered this now for a long time, we never know. We're never given timetables. When decisions will be made, they just appear, you know, like Venus on a half shell without notice. I have my doubts about the British government allowing the European Court of Human Rights, which is the parliamentary. The parliamentary arm of the Council of Europe, which created the European Court of Human Rights, along with the Commissioner for Human Rights, both openly oppose Julian's detention, extradition, and prosecution, and have called it a dangerous precedent for journalists. So if he exhausts every legal avenue, I would be surprised if the British government, they've actually kind of commissioned legal briefs to prove that, well, in their eyes, I mean, it's a distortion, of course, of international law, but to prove that they're not beholden to the European Court of Human Rights. So, yeah, that's the last Hail Mary that he's got, but there's a lot of people who think that that would be shut down.
Chris, it's very easy to get lost in the legal weeds here, isn't it? I'd like to stop for a moment and give you a chance to talk about why this really is so important. The whole question of freedom of the press, it's been said that that press freedom is, you can't have democracy without it, for God's sakes. U.S. democracy is already not by any measure a full democracy. And certainly freedom of the press has been getting attacked all over the place. But talk to us a bit about that. I mean, how can people in a supposedly democratic society, if they don't know what their government is doing in their name, and in the case of war and war crimes, my goodness, how are they supposed to have an informed opinion as to how they want to vote well in the next election? So talk to us about why this case, if it goes against Assange, represents a real nail in the coffin of free press and therefore democracy in America.
Well, I think first I have to acknowledge that the literally hundreds of thousands of cables and documents, including the collateral murder video, was, in terms of scope, unlike anything we've seen, I would say in many ways even more important than the Pentagon Papers, which focused on the Vietnam War. These cables had implications globally in terms of it ignited the Arab Spring. It exposed in Haiti that the U.S. government was collaborating with or pressuring the Haitian government not to raise the minimum wage in the sweatshops, and workers were organizing to attempt to do that. You have Levi Strauss, all these big corporations go down there. I think the minimum wage, they wanted to raise it from $2 to $3 or something. I can't remember. I think that's a day, if I remember correctly. It's certainly not much, but when you add it all together, it was money they didn't want to pay. It just had massive implications in countries around the world, not only our own. And I'm friends with the Reuters bureau. The guy who was the Reuters bureau chief in Baghdad when these two Reuters journalists, part of the group of people that were killed in the collateral murder video, these are U.S. helicopter pilots firing on unarmed civilians in the street of Baghdad. So, and the U.S. government, until the release, that video was released, provided by Chelsea Manning to WikiLeaks, lied. I mean, even saying that they couldn't locate it, there wasn't a video, they didn't know what happened, on and on and on. So a functioning press essentially is a powerful check on the abuse of power. And when you remove that ability of the press to monitor and expose abuses of power, then those abuses just grow and grow and grow. And that's why this is so important. And I think that even the, let's call it legacy media, which has been hostile to Julian since the publication of the cables in the Iraqi and Afghan war logs, has recognized that. And you might think that's counterintuitive, that they're hostile. But having worked at the New York Times, they grit their teeth in partnership because, in essence, Julian shamed them into doing their job. That's usually the relationship between independent journalists, I.F. Stone and others, Cy Hirsch, and they shame the commercial press into doing their work. But immediately, especially in The Guardian and The New York Times, they really turned around to destroy Julian. And they did it because they are constricted and bound by commercial interests, and also because access to the powerful is highly prized within institutions like The New York Times. So, I mean, I'm very worried. I mean, if he is extradited and if he is found guilty, I think at that point, there's going to be no ability to shine a lens into the inner machinery of power. It's essentially gone.
Chris Hedges, can you give listeners your last thoughts?
Well, I come out of the traditional media and have watched it atrophy over the decades, and it's quite frightening. Local news has been eviscerated. National news has been, the Washington Post just cut, I think, 240 jobs. But everybody, CNN, NPR, and that really, really frightens me. So coupled with this very aggressive assault against journalism, when you twin it with the diminishing of the capacity of journalists to do their jobs, thousands of journalists have lost their jobs in the last few years. It's really, really frightening, and it presages, at its worst, a kind of new dark age.
I want our listeners to be reminded of how they can follow what you write. So let's give that as well.
You can find my work at chrishedges.substack.com. I have a show on The Real News, but everything goes out on the Substack.
Well, Chris Hedges, as always, wonderful to have talked with you and to have gotten your views. And thank you so very much for joining us here on Law and Disorder again.
Thanks for doing it.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
How does it feel when it's quiet and calm? And will I be denied? How will it feel when it's time to move on? Mother says, kneel and pray. When it gets hard, I will roam those sleeves. Life can be so unkind. I will be found on the edge.
An assassination is a political murder. Malcolm X was assassinated on February 22, 1965, when he was speaking at the Audubon Ballroom in Harlem. The New York Police Department and the FBI were involved. J. Edgar Hoover, the director of the FBI, said, quote, "We must stop the rise of a new black messiah." Days before the NYPD arrested two of Malcolm's bodyguards, who would have protected him that afternoon. Two of the men who were convicted of the murder each served over 20 years in prison and have since been exonerated and released. One person, the trigger man, was convicted and served 45 years, but others involved have gone free as a result of the withholding of information by the police and the FBI. Civil rights lawyer Ben Crump, who represented the family of George Floyd, has been retained by Malcolm X's daughters to pursue the matter. On his team are attorneys Flynn Taylor, Ben Elson, and Roy Hamlin. The function of the FBI and the police departments nationwide is to protect the status quo. Hoover and the NYPD recognized the threat Malcolm posed with his newly formed Organization of African American Unity. Malcolm X was rapidly evolving into a socialist revolutionary. He had said with respect to the capitalist order that it could not produce social justice, that a chicken cannot lay a duck egg, and that if it ever did, it would be a pretty revolutionary chicken. Malcolm was killed on February 22, 1965. The FBI opened a file on him in 1953. Thereafter, he was under constant surveillance. In 1964, the year before he was killed, the head of the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover, commanded, quote, "Do something about Malcolm X." Malcolm was assassinated the next year. Malcolm X stood for black consciousness, unity in action, solidarity with those struggling against imperialism, independence from the two capitalist political parties, and a deep sense of love for people. To learn more about this, on the 59th anniversary of the assassination of Malcolm X, we speak with attorney Flint Taylor, a founder of the greatly respected People's Law Office in Chicago. Attorney Taylor successfully represented the family of Fred Hampton after he was assassinated by the Chicago Police Department and the FBI in 1969. Flint Taylor is the author of The Torture Machine. Flint Taylor, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
It's great to be back with you and Jim, to staunch Lawyers Guild lawyers and fighters for justice.
Thanks, Lint. Attorneys, including yourself, held a press conference on February 22nd, the 59th anniversary of the assassination of Malcolm X. It was held at the location where he was murdered. What was the purpose of the press conference?
Well, the purpose was, of course, yesterday was the 59th anniversary of the assassination of Malcolm X. And it was to talk about and to reveal new evidence concerning the assassination that's been developed in the last 2 and 3 years, and specifically to have a couple of very important live witnesses speak about their experiences having to do with the assassination and the involvement of a Red Squad New York Police Department undercover informant's role in making sure that two of the main people who were supposed to guard Malcolm at the Audubon Theater the day he was assassinated were off the scene as a result of a bogus conspiracy arrest that was engineered by the undercover agent.
Flint, you are representing Malcolm X's four daughters now, and you're going to be suing the New York Police Department, the FBI, and the CIA. What is it that you're going to be alleging specifically that they did?
Their outlines of what they did are becoming clearer and clearer. What is still to be determined is the complete picture of the involvement of FBI, CIA and New York Police Bossie Unit involvement. And that evidence was the tip of that iceberg was revealed about 2.5 years ago when the DA Vance, along with the Innocence Project in New York, were able to not only obtain the exoneration of two men who were wrongfully charged, convicted, and imprisoned for the assassination of Malcolm X, but to reveal evidence that more strongly pointed towards those government agencies as willing accomplices in the assassination and as bold actors in the cover-up, which not only led to these wrongful convictions of two men who were innocent of the charges of assassinating Malcolm, but also raised the questions and started to give even more definitive answers about the role of the FBI and the CIA and the Bossie of the New York Police Department.
59 years have passed since the assassination. What and why has it taken so long in the pursuit of justice for the daughters? And please talk about this and tell us about the influence of the Wood Letter also, please.
Well, it's hard to answer that question. Government cover-up, you have to use a very, very strong crowbar. that's not only built by lawyers and legal people who want to fight, families and supporters who want to fight, but a movement that often is the catalyst for looking at and changing narratives and uncovering evidence. And particularly when you take a leader of the significance, not only nationally but internationally, of Malcolm X, there's even more incentive on behalf of the governments to keep secret their roles. And so this is little pieces have come out over the years. Obviously, in the one of the reasons they asked me to be involved in the case was my involvement in the Fred Hampton Black Panther assassination. And in the 70s, there was the uncovering of COINTELPRO, the infamous FBI program. And in that uncovering, we learned that the messiahs that the FBI were targeting were not only going forward at Dr. King at that point, and Fred Hampton and others, Stokely Carmichael, Kwame Ture, who are alive, but they also claimed credit or of Malcolm X, who had, of course, been assassinated 4 years before these documents were authored by J. Edgar Hoover himself under COINTELPRO. So pieces came out before, but in fact, they were able to keep it covered up, and there was no lawsuit brought like there was with regard to Fred Hampton in Chicago, in New York, that directly dealt with the assassination of Malcolm X. And represented the families in the pursuit of evidence in that case. Instead, the evidence was sought in the various criminal proceedings. Our great friend, late friend Bill Kunstler, had affidavits that he obtained like 12 years after the assassination from the one man who has been convicted rightfully of the assassination of Malcolm X, who said the other two fellows that you prosecuted were not involved, and named the people who were. But, of course, at that point, the DA's office, and particularly Bossie and the FBI, had no interest in dealing with who actually did it, and therefore the judge just dismissed that petition back in the 70s, and then even though there was attempts to get evidence, there was no vehicle to do so until the reinvestigation that the Innocence Project, together with D.A. Vance, did in the early 220s. Well, the Ray Wood question that you posed is very interesting and disturbing. He was a bossy undercover agent. He was the one, as I referenced, who was set up the two men, one of whom spoke live yesterday at the press conference, to be charged and wrongfully convicted for a alleged plot to blow up the Statue of Liberty. And he did that, according to the men who were framed into it, in their view, to keep Malcolm X's security from being there to protect him. And that most of that evidence was not known until Ray Woods himself died a few years ago. And according to his cousin, he left a typed confession of sorts in which he talked about this frame-up and said that he was working for the bossy, and said that he did it at the behest of his superiors at Bossie, and that in his view or in his statement, it was to do exactly what these men have come forward and said was the purpose, which was to assure that Malcolm wouldn't have his full complement of bodyguards. And also, they raised the question of whether Ray Woods himself was in the auditorium and rushed out of the auditorium as one of the first couple of people who exited upon the assassination.
Flint, I wonder, you've mentioned the exoneration of the two men, Mr. Islam and Mr. Aziz are their names, who served 20 years in prison after being falsely accused in the Malcolm X assassination. Why did it take 20 years? Why were they finally exonerated? Talk to us a little more about that.
Mr. Aziz is still alive. Mr. Islam, the other wrongfully convicted man, had passed several years before the exoneration took place. And as I said, back in the late 70s, when Mr. Halim first came forward with Bill Kunstler, it was rejected by the courts. And there was a judge named Rothwax who took completely the word of the DA, and the DA said, I've seen all the documents that have been produced to me, and there's no evidence whatsoever that these men were wrongfully convicted, and that it, you know, the fact that this man, the Halim, is naming other people is not credible. And, of course, that's where it lay for decades. Now, the men that were named in that affidavit and in that hearing back in the late 70s was a man by the name of William Bradley, another man named McKinley, and another man named Benjamin Thomas, and there was a fourth man named as well, named Davis. And Halim told of the roles of all those men. And he said William X. Bradley, a former lieutenant in the Newark Mosque, was the man who wielded the shotgun that actually murdered Malcolm X, that Davis had fired shots that had also hit Malcolm, and that the other two had been involved in creating a disturbance that was designed to distract everybody. And they did that by actually throwing a smoke bomb just prior to the time of the assassination. So he laid it all out in the late 70s. It was rejected at that time, but when Vance and the Innocence Project took on the case, what would it be, almost 40 years later, they were obtained a lot of documents that still existed, including a trove of FBI documents that showed that Hoover was right on top of all of this, that there were 9 FBI informants involved in this, in the ballroom at the time of the assassination, there were a trove of Bossie documents as well, all of which the defense didn't have, and also just some remarkable evidence about Bradley himself, that there was an FBI file on Bradley. We haven't seen it yet. There was an FBI agent in charge of that file, that Bradley somehow escaped, and that 4 years later, Bradley was arrested in a federal bank robbery where he was wielding a shotgun. He was, in terms of the files of the FBI, known as an NOI, Nation of Islam enforcer. And lo and behold, he, Bradley, was exonerated by the DOJ, cut loose in the case, given bond, then cut loose, while his co-defendant got 25 years. So that all points to the fact that Bradley may well have been an FBI informant. Then the question becomes, was he doing, you know, the business of the FBI at the time that he wielded that shotgun? These are some of the questions that obviously remain to be looked at, and that will be further alleged in the lawsuit that the family plans to file.
This is Attorney Michael Smith. I'm with Attorney Jim Lafferty, my former law partner, and we're speaking with Attorney Flint Taylor. Flint, you represented the estate of the incredible young Black Panther leader, Fred Hampton. You demonstrated the Chicago Police Department and the FBI were behind his 1971 assassination. What parallels do you see in these two cases? Please talk about COINTELPRO for those listeners who do not know what it was.
Yes, there are tremendous parallels here, and this is one of the reasons that Attorney Crump asked me and my associates, including your nephew, Ben Nelson, to become involved in this case. Fred Hampton, like Malcolm X, was a great young leader. Of course, Fred was only 21, whereas Malcolm was at the ripe old age of 39 when he was assassinated. But the parallels in terms of the targeting by the FBI of these leaders The fact that informants were so integrally involved, we were able to prove that in the Fred Hampton case. We are headed toward in that direction, as I just mentioned, in regard to Malcolm's case. The fact that there was cooperation between federal and state agencies to accomplish the goal, which was stated in their own documents, to neutralize, disrupt, and ultimately destroy the targeted black liberation leaders and their movements, and to prevent not only the rise of messiahs, as J. Edgar Hoover talked about, but to destroy coalitions between black liberation organizations and other movement organizations. So all of that background was part of the assassination of Fred Hampton, and as it comes to be pieced together here in the case of the assassination of Malcolm X, we see the same outlines. We see the similar cover-ups in our case. We were able, because we had litigation, to ultimately uncover the FBI's role. They had kept it secret, and that role not only included the infiltration of an FBI informant into the Panthers, who drew the floor plan, which showed where Fred Hampton would be sleeping, and in fact was sleeping when they assassinated him, but also that it was part of this COINTELPRO program. And the COINTELPRO program, I alluded to earlier, was a program initiated by Hoover and his associates, William Sullivan, George Moore, and that crew down in Washington, that started out focusing on what could kindly call dirty tricks, in reality disruption, unconstitutional and illegal activities by the FBI and this super secret program. And they started by targeting Socialist Workers Party, the Communist Party. They had even targeted Marcus Garvey before they had a name for the COINTELPRO program. But when the Black Liberation Movement became so strong in the 60s, the organizations like SNCC and Stokely Carmichael, Dr. King, and then, of course, the Nation of Islam and the OAAU, the organization that Malcolm founded when he left the Nation of Islam, those became the ripe targets of this COINTELPRO program, and the tactics became much more violent and aggressive. And that's where we're left with the assassination of Hampton. We're left with them using informants to sow dissent, to provoke incidents where people would be arrested and falsely charged, to work with police organizations in Chicago. It was the police department and the state's attorney's office. And in New York, it was the Bossie Red Squad. All of this is part of the concept of COINTELPRO, that ultimately, after Watergate, the Church Committee, the Senate Select Committee, when it did its study and wrote its report about the FBI and the CIA, among other things, found that one of the things that the COINTELPRO program was designed to do illegally and was intended to do was to destroy, and that's their term, the Black Panther Party. So what we have under COINTELPRO and what obviously targeted Malcolm X in the mid-60s was a program that was designed not just to surveil, not just to wiretap, but in fact to disrupt, neutralize, and ultimately destroy leadership and the organizations that were targeted by the FBI under COINTELPRO and particularly the Black Liberation movements.
Flint, in this intended lawsuit now, you represent Malcolm X's four daughters. I can only imagine what they've gone through, not only at the time of the assassination, but since, for that matter. Talk to us about the injuries that they've suffered as a consequence of this, murder of their father.
It was very powerful yesterday to meet Dr. Shabazz, who was an infant at the time Malcolm was assassinated. and to meet her in the very floor, in the very room that her father was assassinated, at that time the Audubon Ballroom, now the Shabazz Center in New York. And the strength that the family has, and specifically the strength that she exhibited upon meeting her and learning about what she has gone through, what she has fought to establish, including that very center that her mother was instrumental in starting, Betty Shabazz, who's passed away. All of that resonates, obviously, with people who know her, with people who respect her family and respect what Malcolm X had accomplished and would have accomplished if not for being assassinated. And my partners here at the People's Law Office and I, specifically Jeff Haas and Dennis Cunningham, came to become extremely friendly with the family of Fred Hampton. And the mother of Fred Hampton, Iberia Hampton, and the brother and sister of Fred Hampton. And the honor of meeting and understanding the strength of the Hampton family is, I see again, in meeting and starting to be involved in the representation of the Shabazz family, as represented yesterday by Dr. Shabazz. And they have stood fast all these years and have been in pursuit of justice and truth. And so it's the least we can do to help a little bit in that pursuit as we go forward.
Flint Taylor, we're coming down to the end of our allotted time, but before I ask you what you're going to be doing next in the lawsuit and how our listeners can follow your case, I wanted to ask you about the CIA, because I know the CIA is one of the defendants that you're targeting, and there's not that much that we know about the CIA, because it's awfully hard to get information out of them. We do know that Malcolm was scheduled to go to France to speak, and the French wouldn't let him in. And we surmise that the CIA told the French, we're going to do this, and the French said, not on our land, and they wouldn't let him in to kill Malcolm. So can you talk about what you think the connection to the CIA is? And then we want to ask you about what you're going to be doing next and how listeners can follow you.
Yes, as you pointed out, the dark shadow of the CIA is involved in this. Malcolm was, in his last year, after he split with the Nation of Islam, was much more internationalist in his view. He had traveled to Africa on several occasions. He had talked about the having international solidarity. He had moved from a strictly black nationalist view to a more internationalist and more unity type of approach, you know, both nationally and internationally. And he had been meeting with African leaders. And the CIA obviously was hot on his trail, because at that point they were in the game of assassinating liberation leaders in Africa and South and Central America, as history has taught us. And so he was definitely on the radar of the CIA, as well as the FBI and BASI. And you made allusion to the French situation. And I believe just after the assassination, a journalist talked about having spoken to someone in an African embassy in France, who in fact outlined what you just said, that the reason that Malcolm had been not permitted to enter France just about a week before his assassination was exactly that, that France had word or suspected, or however, we obviously don't have the documentation beyond what this journalist has said was recounted to him, and also what Malcolm told a black photographer named Parks just before he was assassinated, where his suspicions lay about being barred from France, because he never had any problems traveling there in the past. That the heat was on, that the focus on his assassination had had been exacerbated. Of course, for the past almost year since Malcolm had left the Nation of Islam, it was an open secret that Elijah Muhammad had basically a hit out for him, and that I think that Ben Crump had a poignant statement about how sometimes the government used black assassins and black persons to do their dirty work. That could be a view of what happened in the ballroom in terms of the nation executioners were acting at the behest of, the encouragement of, and with assurances of being covered by the FBI and Bossie and, in the deepest sense, the CIA.
Flint, our time is sadly up. How can people follow this case and your work?
Well, you can follow our work at peopleslawoffice.org. This case will obviously be in the public eye. We have another important event coming up in May, which, of course, is the birthday of Malcolm X. We will continue to be talking about this case. We're seeking documents from the FBI and Bossie and the New York Police Department. There have been demands made on the mayor, Eric Adams, to do the right thing in this case and to in fact, not only make public the evidence, but also to justly compensate the family, regardless of a lawsuit, and not to fight a lawsuit at this late date, because, in fact, there's no question that the family has been extremely wronged, not only by those who actually pulled the trigger, but by the government agencies and very particularly the New York Police Department and its secret Red Squad.
Flint Taylor, we will be following the case. My hat's off to you for bringing this important case to all of the good folks at the People's Law Office. Thanks so much for joining us on Law and Disorder.
Yeah, my pleasure. Always great to be on the show.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.